This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. So back among our most read stories is what's going on with COVID again and this new variant.
Yeah, we gave you a few headlines. The doctor who alerted the government scientists to the possibility of a new variant said people infected with Omicron are showing milder symptoms than those suffering the Delta strain. Government across the globe, they're stepping up restrictions on travel as the World Health Organization warned that this new variant of the virus, Carol, could fuel a fresh surge in infections.
Right. So we saw so much concern on Friday, saw the market sell off. You see the bounce back today. So investors seem to be calming down as we seem to be feeling like maybe this is manageable, this latest variant. But again, as we mentioned earlier, still a lot to be known.
Well, let's get into it with Dr. Rhonda Meadows, president of Population Health, Providence Health System, joining us on the phone from Renton, Washington. We should remind everyone that if we think back to about 2 years ago, the first case of COVID-19, it was confirmed in Washington State at Providence Regional Medical Center. That was in Everett, Washington, back in January of 2020. Dr. Meadows, it's great to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me back.
So it's so interesting because if we were doing this on Friday, I think the market would be telling us that it's very concerned about this new variant. But the market telling us today that it's not concerned about the new variant. That's what investors are showing us. As a doctor, what are you thinking?
I am going to have to agree with them. I like what you were saying earlier on your show. We actually have seen this movie before. We actually have some best practices and things that we can do. So panic is not the strategy, right? Being informed is how you make your plan. I would agree with them. I think once we realize what we were seeing and what we don't know yet, then people said, okay, wait a minute. Let's just cool our jets for a second and see this thing through.
It is a reminder, right, though, Dr. Meadows, though, that we are constantly kind of racing against time. And if we don't get any kind of full immunity in terms of our society on a global level, we are ultimately going to be at risk of a variant coming out that's going to be more problematic.
I think you are correct. And so this is what viruses do. This is what they live to do. They mutate to try to find some way to propagate themselves. As long as there are pockets of people who are unvaccinated, and we can now see it's not just in your local neighborhood, it's globally. So you are right. As long as there are people locally, regionally, nationally, and globally who are unvaccinated, that is a prime place for more mutations to occur. And at some point, those mutations may actually result in more severe disease. Right now, we don't know that that's the case. We just simply know this is a variant with lots of mutation that is spreading faster than the usual.
Is it, excuse me for cutting you off, we only have about 3 minutes left and we have so much to get to. Is there a chance, Dr. Meadows, that we perhaps could see this variant overtake all the other variants and it be a less mild form of the infection? So essentially the winning variant in terms of nature is one that isn't as dangerous to the population?
Yes. And the reason I say that is that a more virulent or a more severe variant basically would kill off its host.
And ultimately die out.
Yeah. Right. So what we want to do is actually, if we're going to have something that's going to be dominant, let it be the milder version and let it be a milder version that we can use the vaccine against.
Yeah. Does that actually help in creating a much broader immunity across the globe, potentially?
Does what? Having more mutations?
No. Having this latest variant that is not as severe, but perhaps maybe, you know, spreads more easily.
I don't know if that's a way to kind of think about it. I think it's probably more important that the vaccines themselves actually be modified in any way that they need to be to make sure that we're getting the best immunity. And then the vaccines actually get into the arms of people who are unvaccinated or who are under-vaccinated. That's probably more the way we should think about it rather than counting or trying to figure out what a virus is going to do.
How should we think about getting...
Well, yeah, so. No, I get it. I totally get it. I look at society where... getting a vaccine has become so political and people pushing back. So I'm thinking, okay, in the face of maybe people not stepping up and getting the vaccine, how do we get to a better place? And I think, all right, is it just that we get a less severe case of COVID that goes around, a variant that just infects more people, and that they just develop immunity that way?
I think that there are too many mutations, variations that are going to occur with this virus anyway. We can't count on that. We have to take care of the thing that we can control, which is those vaccines. And you know as well as I do that the virus does not care about our politics.
That is so true.
Well, Carol brings up a really good point, because I tweeted about getting a booster last week, and I got some pushback on Twitter from somebody who listens to this show a lot. And he said, he asked if I got tested for antibodies before I did the booster. No, I didn't. I got the booster because the CDC recommended it. And he made the point that if we get boosters in this country, when not the entire world is vaccinated, we're pulling vaccine away from people who haven't gotten it yet. And that's a criticism that I've heard leveled a lot in developed countries. What do you make of that, Dr. Meadows?
So I'm going to tell you that I don't know that it's an either or. I think we can still actually get vaccine and give it to people in other countries that don't have it now. I think we can do that. And I think we can also provide boosters for people, particularly the people 50 and up or people 18 and up who have underlying conditions that would make them more at risk. I don't think this is an either or decision. I think what there has to be is the will to actually get that vaccine doses to poorer nations. Right? I think that's the question. Not whether or not we can produce it, but will we give it to them so they can go ahead and use it?
Right. We're getting some pushback already from some nations who are saying, stop sending them. We have so many at this point. Dr. Meadows, just very quickly, 20 seconds. Are you guys expecting some kind of surge in your system through the colder months? Just quickly.
We are preparing as if it's coming, no matter what, whether it's Delta, whether it's Omicron, or whether it's something new. We are prepared to address any surge.
Okay. Well, we wish you well and a safe and healthy holiday season. Be well. Dr. Rhonda Meadows, President of Population Health over at Providence Health System, on the phone from Washington. This is Bloomberg. So among our most read on the terminal has to do with Twitter. This headline crossed and we're all like, all right, we got to find out what's going on. In fact, Twitter shares, they were up 11% early on in the trade on this news of Jack Dorsey, no longer CEO. Tim, they're down about 2% though.
Let's bring in Mandeep Singh, senior tech industry analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. He joins us on the phone from New York City. Mandeep, help us understand what's going on here. Jack Dorsey had been at the helm since June 1st of 2015, at least in this iteration as CEO. First, he was interim CEO, and then he became full-time CEO again. And since then, the stock has just underperformed its peers and the benchmarks in a massive way. Help us make sense of Twitter's moves today, though, with this announcement.
Yes. So, again, I think Twitter has been a story of continued underperformance when it comes to execution on the ad side. And part of that has to do with, you know, them not being able to add more advertisers to develop a robust ad platform. And I think what happened today was initially investors thought that they would bring in somebody from outside. The CEO search was more comprehensive in the sense, you know, they went about it objectively and they found the best candidate. Well, after 2 hours, we learned they picked up the CTO to be the next CEO, which I think, the way investors are looking at it is it will more or less be a continuation of the existing strategy. Granted, this guy has, you know, credentials in terms of being a product guy. He can definitely improve on that ad platform that I mentioned before. But at the end of the day, when you look at these companies' targets, which they gave at the beginning of the year, you know, 20% user growth, it will be hard because they're not bringing in somebody new. And, you know, I think investors are interpreting it as that those targets won't be met, the 2023 targets. And that's why you're seeing this kind of a stock reaction.
But what does it mean when they bring in, Mandeep, the CTO? Does it say something about changes to come on a tech level? I was trying to think, you know, is there another tech company out there that brought in their CTO and it was a game changer, maybe in a good way, or
well,
was disastrous?
You can think about Microsoft, you know, bringing in Satya,
right,
who was leading the cloud division, to be the CEO of the company. He was an internal candidate. And guess what? He did a phenomenal job in terms of the vision and execution that the company showed after he took over. So I think there is merit to bringing a product guy and, you know, a tech-focused guy to fix all the product issues that Twitter has faced over the years. But in terms of the near-term kind of targets and execution, it doesn't give you the impression that, you know, there will be a drastic change in the company because of this announcement. And I think investors aren't even sure they went about the CEO search in the most comprehensive way. We don't know anything about how long were they looking for a CEO and how many candidates did they have shortlisted. So I think the objectivity of this search isn't very obvious to investors at this point of time.
So help us make sense of this for our audience here, because as I mentioned, shares of Twitter massively underperforming peer Facebook, for example, since the time that Dorsey came on as CEO, underperforming the NASDAQ 100, the S&P 500, the list continues to go on. Is a continuation of what has been happening, a continuation of its strategy, is that a good thing for investors?
Well, so when you look at the social media space, that has evolved quite a bit in the last, 5 years. We were mostly focused on text-based content. Then, videos, short-form videos really became a craze. You saw the rise of TikTok. Well, Twitter didn't really participate in any of those trends. When you look at a company like Snap, which is growing 50%, which continues to think they can grow 50%, even with their core audience being, the younger demographic, they're doing something right in terms of monetization using ads. In stark contrast, Twitter is growing, 18-20%, and that is in line with the digital ad market growth. So it makes you wonder, Twitter with its kind of engagement, and really it's one of the most under monetized platform on the internet. It's got a very high level of engagement. It's got
right.
a core user base that uses it, but they're still not able to monetize it. So the core problem does lie in execution and, how they show the targeted, whether the ads are actually targeted or not. And that is why you see those kind of numbers, trailing the likes of Snap.
Mandeep, just real quickly, 25 seconds. Can they monetize Twitter in a more effective way? Is it just bad management, or is it just like we've been having this conversation about Twitter for a long time? Can they really effectively monetize it in a better way? Just quickly.
They can, and they have to think about the next version of social media, and it has to factor in metaverse. That's why Facebook and Snap, everyone is going after metaverse. So they have to think long term here and not just fixing the holes.
I've seen this movie before.
Yeah,
we'll see what happens.
Twitter's product just hasn't evolved the way that other platforms have. And like Mandeep said, social media has changed so much in the last 5 years.
And yet it's such a part of certainly our world, the media world, but I think a lot of people use it fairly effectively to communicate. All right, Mandeep Singh of Bloomberg Intelligence, thank you so much. Tim and I were just talking about this. The most important abortion case in a generation will be argued Wednesday before the nation's top court. 9 justices will decide that outcome. And Tim, the veteran litigator that will be arguing the case is betting on a precedent to save abortion rights.
It's Julie Rickleman, and David Yaffe Bellany writes all about her in the most recent issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. You can read it on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com. Joining us now is David Yaffe Bellany and Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. Week. The precedent when it comes to Roe v. Wade. Am I going to get this right, Joel? Stare Decisis? Stasis?
Boy, it's maybe let
term.
David take that one.
Yeah.
But, the thing that we often try and do at the magazine with stories like this is we know that there's this news event coming that is basically could be one for the ages, have generational consequences in terms of what this outcome looks like. And if we do our jobs well, there's often a character sort of at the center of that storm. And that's what just immediately caught my attention when David started talking to us about the attorney who's actually going to be defending in front of the court. So David, tell us more about Julie Reichelman.
Sure. So she's one of the kind of preeminent abortion law litigators in the United States. The last time there was a major abortion case at the U.S. Supreme Court, which was about a year and a half ago, she was arguing it on the side of the abortion clinics. So she's very seasoned and has been doing these sorts of cases for decades and decades. But this is, you know, as important as it gets. And one of the reasons I was interested in her was to kind of understand how it feels like to be somebody with the kind of, you know, weight of the world on your shoulders going into this sort of argument.
And how's she doing with the weight of the world on her shoulders?
I think she's holding up fine. I mean, you know, like I was saying, she's very experienced and she's argued at the Supreme Court before. So I think that that helps. But she says it's definitely stressful. And, you know, she's working long days to get ready, doing kind of trial arguments and in front of experienced litigators at law firms in D.C. and other places. So she's, you know, working really hard to make sure that that she's ready for arguments on December 1st.
Well, what do we know about her approach for arguments come this week and in the context of how she argued the Louisiana case? What does her strategy center on?
Sure. So, I mean, at the heart of this case is a decades-old precedent in Roe v. Wade. It's very rare, though not unheard of, for the Supreme Court to overturn its own precedent. And one of the things that she's going to be stressing is the principle of stare decisis and the importance of kind of maintaining settled law and not creating chaos unnecessarily by sort of changing tracks kind of on a whim. So that's going to be the heart of our argument. I mean, it's similar to how she defended the or how she opposed this law in Louisiana a year and a half ago. The difference now is that the court's changed. Amy Coney Barrett's on the court now. It's a much less sympathetic set of justices to abortion rights, and so the challenge is greater than it's ever been.
So you laid that out really well, David, and I am kind of curious to like what we know going into this case about how the court feels, as you've established, about abortion and abortion rights, but also in terms of how they view the precedent in which she will probably argue the case.
Sure. So, I mean, we know that there are, you know, three liberal justices on the court who are basically, you know, a sure vote for upholding Roe v. Wade. Then you've got John Roberts, who we all understand, you know, really kind of values the institutional legitimacy of the court, doesn't want to do anything to undermine that. He sided with Julie Rickleman in striking down the Louisiana law a year and a half ago. And so, you know, the hope is that he'll be on board, too. So that's four of the five votes that you need. And then you've got the five most conservative justices on the court. And the question is there one of them that she can win over? And Amy Coney Barrett looks like a tough one to win. She's been written critically about abortion in her kind of career as a law professor before she became a justice. And so I think that the hope in the pro-choice community is that somebody like Brett Kavanaugh can be swung. Like, a lot less is known about where he stands on abortion. He hasn't written or talked about it that much. And so the hope is that he's persuadable. But I think everybody understands that it's a long shot.
And that's right. Like, it, kind of an amazing circumstance to find that Brett Kavanaugh, who had such a tumultuous hearing, would be the person who could be something of a swing vote here. So what do we know about the little that he's spoken about the issue? What do we know?
Well, one kind of quirk of history is that in the early 1990s, when the court reaffirmed Roe v. Wade in a case called Planned Parenthood v. Casey, basically kind of striking a compromise that kind of chipped away at Roe a little bit but kept its essential holding intact. At that time, Brett Kavanaugh was clerking for a lower court judge who kind of heard the case before it reached the Supreme Court. And, you know, while he was clerking, that judge issued an opinion that basically laid out the compromise that the Supreme Court later adopted. So Kavanaugh was sort of tangentially involved in the kind of most comparable historical precedent for what's happening now, a case like really challenging the heart of Roe v. Wade. And he was clerking for a judge that basically, you know, helped lay out the compromise that kept Roe intact. So, you know, it's a quirk of history, and obviously a lot's happened in Brett Kavanaugh's career since then. He's become, you know, more kind of closely wedded to the conservative legal movement. But the hope is that it, you know, his role in that kind of historical event, you know, maybe indicates that there's some flexibility.
I mean, ultimately, is this about a lawyer with a great argument before the Supreme Court justices, or is this just about the technicalities of law before those Supreme Court justices? What will it come down to ultimately?
Well, I don't think those things are fully extricable necessarily. Okay. But there's definitely a school of thought that there's really not a lot that Julie Rickleman can do herself, that, you know, you've got nine justices who've thought about this issue plenty, who've read the briefing and have probably already made up their mind, and there's like a limit to what she can accomplish. And there's a defeatist version of that argument that you hear from some people in the pro-choice community, including the woman who argued that Planned Parenthood v. Casey case, which is that there's nothing that Rickleman can do, and that, you know, the numbers are the numbers, and you've got six conservative justices, and it's just too much to hope that, you know, two of them could be swayed.
David, just in the last 30 seconds that we have with you, what happens if Rickleman ends up losing?
Well, it sort of depends on how she loses. You know, there are different ways that Roe could be either overturned or significantly watered down. But the most immediate effect, there are a bunch of states that have what are called trigger laws that ban abortion the moment Roe v. Wade is overturned. And so those would go into effect, and you'd see women in large swaths of the country lose access to abortion.
Amazing. A great story. And as Joel said, telling it through an individual who's going to be smack in the middle of it all before those Supreme Court justices. David Yaffe Bellany, thank you so much. Legal reporter at Bloomberg News on the phone from New Jersey. Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. He's in our Interactive Broker studio. Find this story in the current issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, you are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Messer along with Tim Stenovic in our Interactive Brokers studio. So too is Bloomberg New Economy Editorial Director Andy Brown here in studio with us. Andy, interesting story on the terminal that says China would face a colossal outbreak on a scale beyond anything any other country has yet seen if it were to reopen in a similar manner to the U.S. We're talking about COVID. We're talking about closing borders, not closing borders. How do you see this?
Yeah, so this really confirms the general view that China has no intention of backing away from its COVID zero policies. And if anything, is going to double down with this new Omicron variant. So what happened was a bunch of statisticians at Peking University asked the question, what would happen if China opened up just like the United States? In other words, adopted a pretty laissez-faire attitude to COVID restrictions. And the answer is it would be an absolute catastrophe for China that within 1 or 2 days, you'd get infections going from where they are now, mm-hmm. which is about 100 a day, give or take, to 630,000, of which 20,000 would be serious cases, and it would completely swamp the Chinese healthcare system.
Is it just a numbers thing? I mean, here in the U.S., we have more than 100,000 cases a day, roughly.
It is partly a numbers thing. I mean, China's population is 1.4 billion.
Right.
But it also reflects the fact that China has a relatively low vaccination rate mm-hmm. of about 55%. The vaccines they use are not the messenger RNA vaccines, Moderna, Pfizer. These are vaccines made in the traditional way using inactive form of the virus or a attenuated watered-down form of the virus. So the efficacy isn't quite as good. And the fact that because China has been in COVID zero, been pursuing COVID zero for so long, there is almost no natural immunity in the entire population.
That's
so you let it in and it just, the numbers go through. Now, it's interesting because I was in Singapore with the New Economy mm-hmm. Forum recently, and they have just started moving away from zero COVID towards COVID endemic. Basically, the understanding that you're not going to defeat COVID, and certainly not these more transmissible variants,
right.
including the Delta variant. So you just got to live with it. Their experience was you went from, I think it was about 20 a day, to thousands a day. I mean, almost overnight. I mean, it went up to 5,000. Mm-hmm. And even in Singapore, of those 5,000, there were enough serious cases to make the government very worried that their ICU units could be overwhelmed. And don't forget, the Singapore healthcare system is about as good as any system in the world. And the Chinese system, outside of the major cities, where it is world-class, medical system is world-class, mm-hmm. in most of the country, in the countryside, it's still medical is still pretty rudimentary.
This is so important. I think about when we talk about the markets and what's atop the list of things that we need to be worried about. If China, you know, continues to be shut down or closed off from the rest of the world, what does that mean in terms of global economic growth or the global economic repercussions?
But you think what that means right now for their efforts to maintain COVID zero in the face of Delta, right? So it means extensive lockdowns. I mean, they shut down the port of Ningbo, the port of Dalian. Mm-hmm. It's going to mean travel restrictions. It's going to mean that, you know, you're going to get more snarls in your supply chains, factories closed down. I mean, look at the latest data. Factory output is slumping. Consumer demand in China is down because people are worried about going out and being exposed to COVID. So it's going to mean a good deal more economic disruption. And that's before Omicron, which is apparent by all accounts, a good deal more transmissible mm-hmm. than Delta. So expect more of the same.
What is life like for people who are under lockdown in China?
So, I mean, it's all quite sudden and random, right? That, you know, they'll lock down whole cities because they found one or two cases. I mean, literally, they have the confidence that they are able to track and trace and chase down every single case in a country of 1.4 billion people, which is about the same size as the United States.
So, Andy, why can't they forgive me? And I'm just kind of playing devil's advocate or something. So if they can track all of this down, will they ultimately track everyone down and just put a shot in everybody's arm and basically do it? Because is that their only savior in terms of kind of reopening?
Well, the exit for them is going to be a better vaccine, and they're working on mRNA vaccines. We don't know when they're going to deliver one, maybe next year, and therapies. That's really the only exit now that they can hope for.
Well, and it's interesting. You do wonder if the relationship, right, between China and maybe the U.S. or the rest of the world in terms of sharing vaccines, whether that could be a better situation.
Well, Moderna would like to manufacture and has a license to manufacture in China, but they haven't actually started manufacturing yet. I mean, partly this is a question of, you know, we're not going to rely on foreign vaccines to save our population. They've got to be made in China. There's another question now: what happens to the Olympics? You know, now with the Omicron,
what does happen to the Olympics? How do they do that?
Well, you know, the reaction so far to Omicron in China has been pretty much take it in stride. Okay, we've beaten Delta. This is another challenge, but we're going to rise to the occasion. Essentially, we're going to double down.
All right. Well, we will certainly see. But I do know that you talk to market watchers, and they're definitely keeping an eye on what's going on in terms of Chinese growth. Andy, thank you. Really appreciate it. Andy Brown, he's editorial director at Bloomberg New Economy here in our Interactive Brokers studio. And that's something we'll probably talk about with our market close a little bit later on. Among the things that are top the list of market strategists, market watchers, right? It comes down to COVID, China being a huge economic engine for the global economy. And you do wonder if there's problems there, what happens?
We should know Biden meeting earlier in the day with CEOs of companies to talk supply chain. And you have to wonder what a continued shutdown in China means for those companies.
Yeah, exactly. I tried to order some things for Christmas and like...
No luck?
Out of stock.
Happy Valentine's Day, everyone.
Out of stock, exactly. Tim and I talked about some of the retail data points. Retail foot traffic up 31% last week from a year earlier. Shoppers driving U.S. retail sales during Thanksgiving weekend up about 14.1% year over year and up almost 6% compared to 2019. That's according to MasterCard Spending Pulse. There's a lot going on in the retail sector.
Well, fortunately, we have joining us Greg Portell, partner and head of consumer industries and retail practice at Kearney. He joins us on the phone from St. Louis. Greg, help us understand where we are sort of halfway through Cyber Monday, or at least in New York, wrapping up Cyber Monday. What are the metrics telling you about where we are compared to 2019? Because that is the benchmark that all of these companies are using.
Well, I think the The overall message is that the consumer remains very strong. They've been the backbone as we've gone through this rocky period of time. They've been there throughout it, and they're there now. The challenge becomes how to interpret them, because the traditional retail observers are looking for, is it online or is it in store? And in reality, consumers shop all over the place. So it's a little bit misleading to evaluate them on one channel versus another, because we just don't live that way anymore.
No, but that's a good point. But we do try to figure it out, right? Especially as we...
We do try to figure it out, yes.
Well, so, like, what are we doing? Are we, I mean, I don't know. Is it early in the season? Did the Omicron variant, did I say it right?
Omicron.
I knew I said it incorrectly. Omicron variant. Did that freak people out at all? Like, what was going on this weekend?
It's a little too early to tell what the new variant will do to consumers, but if it's like any of the other variants, consumers will blow through the news fairly quickly.
Yeah.
One of the things
we already have, the market's bounced back pretty quickly.
Yeah, we're back because consumers love to shop. It's our outlet. Retailers were really smart this year, and they started to extend the holiday season. So it didn't really start on Black Friday. It started in the middle of October. And that allowed the consumer to really lengthen their demand cycles, which allowed the retailers to, in turn, handle the pressure of the supply chains a little bit better than they have.
Hey, what do we know right now about what consumers are finding out of stock versus what consumers are actually able to leave a store with? And look, I'll speak anecdotally here. I went and bought a new phone while I was away last week, a very exciting, you know, staycation. And I went into one of the retail locations for the provider that we have, and they didn't actually have any of the phones in stock, but they said, we can FedEx one to you and it'll be there in, you know, 2 or 3 days, which is fine, right? But when I did this 3 or 4 years ago for the iPhone 10, they had it in the store.
That is the prediction of demand and the flexibility of the consumer are really two components of that story. We did a survey of consumers and asked them, hey, how loyal are you to particular brands or particular items? And shockingly, 45% said that they would go to a different store to find an item that they wanted. So it really isn't the out of stock that's going to trigger the problem. It's the how much disruption is there from going to one store to another. You know, with the online options, it's pretty easy to shop and find the item that you want, even if it's not in stock at your first choice.
You know, and I did pop into a Target over the weekend to pick up something, and it was a little bit of a madhouse.
Did you order it online, then go pick it up, or
I did order something online. They said they had it, and then like en route, they're like, "Sorry, out of stock." And I walked into the store, found it on the shelf, like randomly. So I do think it was either misplaced, and they, you know, it was low. So, but yeah, I did think about, I'm gonna do it online and just make sure I have it, and then ultimately I had to go to the store anyway. And play around.
You point out a real problem for retailers. One, their IT backbones are not as robust as they need to be to track all of those moving parts. And consumers have really lost patience with the companies that can't figure it out. I mean, there was a certain amount of tolerance for that kind of inconvenience at the first part of the pandemic. But now consumers are expecting retailers to fulfill their consumer promise. And if you're people like you are going to the store expecting to be able to pick up the product and it's not there, that's going to have repercussions for the retailer down the road.
I was ticked off. I'm going to be quite honest with you, because I was like, you sent me a confirmation that I had it. And then I was kind of like, what? Because I might have raced to the store quicker or I don't know what I would have done differently.
This happened to me.
We don't have patience for that anymore.
Yeah.
So what's the best practices for consumers right now if they're looking to get their holiday shopping done? How should they be thinking about the supply chain snarls and navigating this?
Well, if you're a shopper like me that depends on Christmas Eve to do your shopping, that's probably a bad idea this time of year. I mean, consumers should think about getting to the store early, having flexibility in what they want. I mean, the Tickle Me Elmo doll that you had in your head, your heart set on, probably isn't going to be there this year.
Yeah.
So shop early, and, you know, as a retail observer, shop often.
Yeah. But it is interesting to see the equity trade today, because we see a lot of the online retailers, put Amazon aside, you see a lot of them like Etsy and a few others that are struggling a little bit because of some of the early numbers.
Yeah, and I wonder how much of it is a reflection of what happened late last week. Was Etsy sort of seen as a stay-at-home boon? I don't know.
It's like complicated.
It is complicated.
Complicated. That's the word of the day.
Omicron.
Omicron.
Okay, so the translation is return, 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 right?
Yeah!
Well done.
Thank you.
How many years of Spanish did you take?
We'll study abroad, action in college.
Nicely done.
Actually, yes. So, Volver, Volver, you've identified the title of the song. That's not bad.
So we're talking about returns for Latin
America?
Well,
yeah, that's what we're talking about. That particular version of the song done by Los Lobos. It actually came out on a single they released themselves before they got signed and, you know, made a name for themselves as recording artists. And, you know, that particular song is one of my wife's favorites.
Aww.
So, I mean, she learned it, from her father. He was a fan.
This goes out to Dave's wife.
There you go.
Sandy. Can I say that?
You can say it if you want. In any case.
Is she listening?
I don't know.
We'll find out.
Right. We'll find out.
You'll find out tonight when you go home for dinner.
Yeah, absolutely.
Might be a little extra dessert for you.
So. Yeah, maybe.
Because she made her day.
Yeah, I try to do what I can. Right. Especially, you know, because I'm going to be spending more time with her very soon.
Exactly.
In any case, yeah, Latin America, that's what it's all about. I mean, this is something that Michael Hartnett over at Bank of America, who's their chief global equity strategist, highlighted in a report last week, a comparison between the MSCI Latin American Index, which we should point out is dollar denominated. That's sort of a key issue. And the S&P 500. And you look at where the ratio has been this month. It reached its lowest level since January 1988, which is particularly important because the index's base is the end of 1987. So in other words, you're practically back to its very beginning at this point. And the ratio has come down 89% from a record set back in October 2010. You look at what's going on with Latin markets this year. Mexico's up a bit. Thing is, though, when you figure in the dollar, those gains sort of erode. And then you look across South America, you see markets like Brazil down in part because of lower share prices. But again, weakness in the currency relative to the dollar. Similar story elsewhere, like Chile, for example. So it's really a continuation of something that's been going on for more than a decade. And it's not like Hartnett came out in his research and said, you know, you should do something about this. He was pointing it out just to show kind of a distortion, arguably, that's gone on in the market over time.
Well, and so, there's a lot of markets, I feel like, throughout South America, Central America. They've been struggling, like generally speaking. But then you factor in, right, the stronger dollar, and it just... is really rough.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, and you think about Brazil and you know what they've been going through with their current president Jair Bolsonaro and the issues they've had with COVID and everything else. And you can sort of understand why Latin America more broadly is in the situation it's in. You know, in Brazil, you figure is the biggest country in the region. If they're having issues, you know, you're going to see weakness elsewhere.
Dave, do you have your charts picked out for the next 2 days?
Yes.
Okay.
There's more to come.
Okay.
I also have my stock of the day picked out for today.
Let's hear it.
That would be Berry Global. It's a maker of plastic packaging and other products. And they've got this activist investor and core group. They don't have the biggest stake, only about 1% by their calculations at least. They came out, though, sent a letter to the board, said you should take a look at your options, including either doing a buyout or selling yourself to somebody else. And whenever you see that sort of thing come up, you know, people pay attention. And Berry Global, the ticker is BERY. That's one R, even though the company name has two, as you'd expect. Well, the shares set a record today in response to this letter. And at the moment, they're up about 8%.
Yeah, it's a stock that I'm just looking since about mid-October has been like bouncing off their lows and has been had quite a trajectory. But the market cap is something that you could see a lot of investors being interested in maybe it doing something, right?
Yeah, I mean,
it falls into that kind of
just
spot.
Below $10 billion.
All right, Dave Wilson. Dave, don't go. Dave, don't go.
You can also check out Dave's stock
Sandy's
of the day
calling.
Just after 4:15 p.m. Wall Street time. It's on Facebook, LinkedIn, and on Twitter at The One Dave.
I'm driving in my car.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no. This is not a toy.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive home.
Excuse me, I wanna drive. You drive
me crazy. It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
TikTok, everyone. Just about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. Quite a reversal from what we saw on Friday. Remember, the Friday was a lighter trade in terms of market participants, but nonetheless, we are seeing a bounce back in today's trade. Not necessarily gaining back all the ground that we lost, certainly with those major market averages, but nonetheless, definitely seeing a pop. Let's get to it with our market guest.
Dave Donabedian is Chief Investment Officer at CIBC Private Wealth Management. He joins us on the phone from Baltimore. Dave, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. Help us make sense of what exactly is going on with the sell-off that we saw on Friday and what the market is telling us now about the way that it's feeling about Omicron.
Yeah, well, I think if you, you know, before Friday, we had a market that was, either soaring or complacent about risk, depending on your point of view. And then, Friday on a holiday shortened trading session, a new issue was injected, Omicron, and complacency turned to fear. Although it was orderly, perhaps a little bit volatility on Friday, a little bit exacerbated by a lack of trading volume. But then I think what we have all learned in the last 20 months in a coronavirus environment is that investors are adaptable, economies are adaptable. And so I think with a little bit of time to think about it, investors today said, well, the Delta variant was a very important and significant health concern. It did slow the economy a little bit, but markets looked right through it. And, let's not jump to conclusions here. And, I think that's really important. We know very little about Omicron. In fact, the experts are sort of sending different messages. The WHO referred to the risk of Omicron as being very high. And hours later, the head of the South African Medical Association said that from what they could see, the patients with symptoms, those symptoms were extremely mild. So is the risk very high, or is this something with extremely mild symptoms? I think we're going to go through another couple of weeks of fact-finding, but probably with market volatility associated with it until there's more clarity, particularly about whether the vaccines will be effective.
Dave, a wise person said to me just recently, we don't even know how to say this. We are still kind of early in the stages when it comes to that person's initials are TS.
Look,
happens to be my co-host. But I mean, I'm not making light because people are getting sick still, and we know there's nothing funny about COVID and where we are and the impact it's had on society. But you make a good point, right? I mean, Tim, we're early on. We're still trying to figure this out, this variant.
You know, and to some extent, Dave, it kind of felt like on Friday, a repeat of what happened in March of 2020, when the world was quickly learning about something mm-hmm. new that it hadn't experienced. And then, we speak earlier in the show with Dr. Rhonda Meadows from the Population Health Management at Providence in Washington State. And she says, what did she say, Carol? We've seen this play out before.
Exactly.
We've seen this movie before. Don't panic.
Exactly. And we have to take some time with
and
it.
She said the market was right.
Yeah, exactly. And it is interesting, the resiliency, right? We see when investors are like, get some clarity and they bounce back. Having said that, we've talked about, and I think a lot of market watchers, certainly earlier this year, Dave, were talking about this being a much more volatile market. And we've seen the VIX swing around, certainly Friday, certainly again today. How do you anticipate market action or what are you expecting in terms of market direction, maybe is a better question, as we turn into a new year? It's just around the corner.
Yeah, so we think that the market direction for equities is still higher, but our message is, sort of cautiously optimistic. Probably if you take a 6 to 12 month time frame, it's probably more of a single digit market return. And to your point, with higher levels of volatility, and that was our view even before this latest, piece of news on the coronavirus, because you have, valuations that are certainly full. We're at, past peak policy support, both monetary and fiscal policy. So so not quite as much of a catalyst there. And a year in which you know, we expect earnings in 2020 to be positive, but of course not up nearly as much as 2021. So a more muted environment with higher volatility, which really, what I'm saying is a more historically normal environment compared to what we've seen in the last 3 years.
So we're also on the watch for a lot of economic data this week that we're set to get. Pending home sales for October this morning, hitting a new high for the year. We're expecting ISM manufacturing on Wednesday. And of course, that jobs report on Friday morning. We're, at least now, according to economists surveyed by Bloomberg, we're looking at just around 550,000 jobs added for the month of November. Apart from the jobs report, what's the most recent, what's the most important piece of economic data for us to keep an eye on, Dave?
Yeah, I think the other thing I have my eye on is, you know, any piece of inflation data. Obviously, we're very bullish on the economic outlook, the growth outlook, right through next year. And you mentioned a lot of the data. We think it's going to continue to get stronger, but we're also in the sort of higher for longer camp on inflation. I think that, you know, some of these supply chain shortages will ease over the next 6 to 12 months, but we're seeing stronger wage growth, and we think we've not even seen the peak of that yet. We have rising shelter costs and just this incredible amount of liquidity sloshing around. And so the notion that you even see in the Fed's own forecast of inflation settling back down around 2% by the end of next year, we don't think that's going to happen. We think the new normal for inflation is going to be, you know, is going to start with a 3 point something instead of 1 or 2%.
There's your new normal. And,
that's exactly, and that's not the end of the world for equities, but the transition related to that change in expectations is going to mean probably a more aggressive tightening path for the Fed over the next couple of years than investors currently anticipate.
But I do think about the spending power of individuals. We know consumers have been so crucial to this economic recovery, and then you do wonder if their purchasing power is reduced because of inflation, or there's definitely, we're seeing wages in some sectors, but not necessarily everywhere, and you do wonder with the inability of wages to maybe keep up, whether or not that starts to dampen some of the earnings outlook going forward. Hey, Dave, we got to run. Thank you so much. Dave Donabedian, he's Chief Investment Officer over at CIBC Private Wealth Management, on the phone from Baltimore. What?
Wage growth, important number to keep an eye on Friday when we get those jobs numbers for the current month that we're in.
And how much is it spread out? We've seen certainly wages go up in some of the lower end or lower paying jobs, which is a good thing because they've lagged for so long.
Labor force participation as well.
Exactly.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.